So welcome everyone. It's really nice to see such a great group here. Welcome to LSE Sociology. And my name is Juan Pablo Pardo Guerra. It's a bit of a mouthful, so you can call me JP. That's sort of the easy way of doing it. And I'm going to give you an idea of what LSE Sociology is all about, what classes consist of, what lectures, type of topics covered in lectures, and that makes a stop of sociology in a sense. So today I'm going to give you an overview of the presentation. We're going to talk a little bit about sociology. What is sociology all about? Then I'll introduce the department, what we do, where we are positioned in terms of sociology and so forth. And then I'll talk a little bit about the program, what you will study and what you'll gain from being a student in sociology at the LSE. I do apologize for the bizarre organization of the tables. It was very last minute. It wasn't precisely as prepared as I would have liked it to be, but we'll deal with that later on. So let's start with what we can think of as the trivial question. What is sociology all about? Raise your hand if you have some experience with sociology, if you've read things in sociology. Fantastic. So you know what sociology is all about. What is sociology? Yes?
Me?
Yeah?
Well, the scientific study of society is kind of like a one-liner, but it's more than that. It's kind of just looking at maybe trying to operationalize how we look at things in society, kind of like looking at them from maybe a different perspective, because I know a lot of other social sciences look at it maybe from an economic point of view, but it's kind of looking at it in a different way.
Yeah, great. So the study of society, and it's a particular approach to this thing we call society, this complex thing, entity, this complex project, space, et cetera, that we call society. And when did sociology start? What is the origin of sociology? Yeah?
Is it with the Karl Marx manifesto?
It's sort of around that time, yes. So there was something going on in the world, in the West, in Europe particularly, that was quite important at the time when Marx and other intellectuals were writing about the social world. Can you think of what that was? Yes?
Is it the Enlightenment and Augustus Comte?
Yeah, they were actually post-Enlightenment, and they were living some of the results of the Enlightenment. They were living sort of the consequences of this great period of intellectual activity, the Enlightenment, which was manifested in, for instance, the Industrial Revolution. And one of the things that you can observe from sociology is that it's very much a theory of change. It's a discipline that deals with change. And if you think about the great sociologists, the big names in the field, they really are about change, social change, and how to grasp, how to deal with this complex thing, society, and the ways in which it evolves over time. So Marx is an example. Marx is all about change, the role of industry and technology in change. Weber is also about change, seen from a historical perspective, and Durkheim is also about change, the way in which societies were transformed in their moral fabric to some extent due to the fact that we now live in this modern time where everything is based on impersonal forms of interaction and control, where technology is so central to the way in which we live our everyday lives. So sociology emerged in this period, and those three great authors, Marx, Weber, and Durkheim, were very much authors and theorists of change, trying to explain these transformations, these great transformations in society. And they weren't the only ones. Actually, change was something in the minds of quite a few people at the time. And if you look at Hollywood, you'll see that change was also part of the psyche of Hollywood to some extent. So you might have seen this classic film, Modern Times. It's actually a very interesting sociological claim on the transformations in the world. It was, it's one of the films produced by Chaplin. And it's basically a story of how industry transformed everyday life and the experiences of the individual in the world. How industry alienated us, made us more distanced from personal relations, and made us basically cogs in a grand machine. Sociologists were dealing with these issues back then, and those issues are at the foundation of the discipline. How does this make sociology relevant for today's world? How do you think this historical origin and these inspirations of sociology are relevant in today's reality. Yes?
Because it's ever changing?
Yeah, it's ever changing, yeah?
Could you say that in the middle of these people are fighting for change as well, so that therefore relevant?
Precisely, if you think of it, the world is still in constant change. We are experiencing tremendous transformations in society. Everything around us is in a state of flux, and sociology can say powerful, intelligent things about those fundamental changes that we are observing in our everyday lives. Everything from war and civil conflict, from the great political confrontations of the world, the Middle East is, for instance, a very good topic for sociological inquiry, to the transformations in cities. What is going to happen to London after the Olympics? What are the Olympics going to do to the fabric of London, to the way in which social relations are played out in this city, in this particular part of the world? It also talks about new movements, new ways of valuing people, valuing the work of particular groups in society. It also is relevant to understanding new forms of work, and forms of work that are consequential to everyday life, for instance, work in financial markets. Sociology is increasingly concerned with understanding what this thing called the market does in everyday lives. It does to our society, how it helps in many ways and how it might also pose risks. Financial markets are another area of exploration for sociology. Mass movements, sort of relatively recent mass movements, which are mobilized or are fueled and triggered by, for instance, new forms of technologies that allow people to communicate in ways that weren't possible in the days of Marx, Weber, Durkheim, etc., etc. And things like crime. Crime is also, interestingly, a very important issue within sociology, and there's a huge tradition within the department in studying crime and the roots, the causes, the social dynamics of crime, criminality, etc., etc. But sociology also says things about more sort of scientific transformations. Sociology can make very interesting claims about the role of science in today's society, how science plays an active role in shaping policies and shaping the way in which individual citizens behave in the world, act in the world, and respond to complex challenges such as climate change, genetically modified organisms, cloning, etc., etc. So sociology can say quite a few things about today's world. And because of that, it is as consequential, as important as it was in the days of Marx, Weber, Durkheim. So it's not about studying these old dead people and what these old dead people wrote 120 years ago. It's about studying the world today as we know it, as it is changing, it is transformed by every single interaction in the social world, in a sense. So I'll give you an example. What can sociology say? What are the types of things that sociology can say about the world? So let's see what sociology does, how it behaves, how it analyzes and explores the world. And the example is simple. The S has a double entendre in a sense, because the example is on this, money. Why is money such an interesting object for sociological inquiry? Because money seems to be something completely asociological. It's just money. Come on, it's something printed by the Bank of England or the Fed in the US or the central bank in Europe. It's just money. What is sociological about money? And actually, the interesting thing is that both today and in the past, money has been an object of inquiry for sociologists because it is so central to the way in which modern societies are organized and modern societies worked. Just a wee little example. How many of you have used money today in one way or another? Everyone, every single day of your lives, in some way or another, you use money. And why is money important? What does money do in society? Yeah?
It gets you stuff.
It gets you stuff. It does things. Money is powerful. Money has a particular role to play in the social world, which is quite important. It defines classes to some extent. It defines the power in society, it defines the power of countries, of institutions, etc., etc. Money is quite interesting. But let's not talk about money in this grander narrative or grander scale. Let's think of money in a more detailed fashion, the way in which, for instance, economists think of money. So actually, let's see what economists think of money. Let's start with that. Why is it important to see what economists say about money? Because they have sort of a certain power of expertise over everything that is monetary and economic. So economists are the only ones that can talk about money, so say a lot of people. Well, actually, let's see if that is true today. So what do economists think about money? Well, Paul Samuelson, one of the most important economists of the 20th century, talked about money as basically something that allows us to make barter and exchange more efficient. That is the idea, the explanation for the role of money in contemporary societies, in the market society, in the modern world. As Samuelson wrote, even the most advanced industrial economies, if we strip exchange down to its bare essentials and peel off the obscuring layer of money, we find trade between individuals and nations largely boils down to barter. So basically, the only reason why there is such a thing as money in the world is because it makes things more efficient. Think of two people who want to buy houses. They want to get rid of their houses to buy another house. Those two families or individuals will face a tremendous problem if they don't have something like money. Why? Because they'll have to find someone out there in the world who would be willing to exchange with them their house. It would be impossible, in practical terms, to live in such a complex society as today's societies if we didn't have money. If you had to exchange, for instance, every single month something with Orange or Three or Vodafone or something like that to get your mobile service, you would have a heck of a hard life. Money makes things easier. Why? Because it's this token that we can use to barter with other individuals. Now, that's what economists say money is, and because it's just a token, they see money as having no other use in society. And that's the only thing money does. And what we'll see today is whether that is true. Now, this is what economists said quite not a long time ago, but this is what economists think money is. Let's see what sociologists said about money in those foundational years of the birth of the discipline. So money in classical sociology, what did they say? What do you expect them to say about money? What do you think? Yes? So there's an issue of power in money, yes? Yeah?
Power, status.
Status, control, yeah?
The functionists will say that money plays a specific role in society.
Yeah, so there's a specific, sorry? Yeah, so there's an issue of the role that money plays in society, which is integral to the dynamics of modernity. And we'll see that your three insights are actually quite clear, really correct insights. So Weber, for instance, talked about money as this, as he wrote, the most abstract and impersonal element that exists in human life, the most perfect means of economic calculation. So he sort of repeated what economists said about money to some extent. But Weber also talks about money as something that provides individuals power, power of access to institutions, a certain status position within the world. So power also is conferred by money. Simmel saw money as something that transforms the world into an arithmetic problem. It is the purest reification of means. It is free from any quality and exclusively determined by quantity. So Simmel saw money as something that was essentially an entity that broke up the world into numbers and made the world only understandable in terms of numbers. And Marx talked of money as the god among commodities. Actually, your insights are more modern than what the classical sociologists wrote. They pretty much saw money in a way that was quite similar to that of economics. And that's very interesting because actually, at the time, the distinctions between sociology and economics weren't too clear. Some of the fundamental sociologists in the history of the discipline were actually a bit of economists too. So your insights are much more modern than what the classical sociologists said. They saw money as something that was integral to modernity. In what way? Money was something that corrupted social relations and that reduced social relations to quantity, to an arithmetic problem. Who is better than whom? That's determined by money. And they saw that as a corrosive force on society. So they conceptualized money in these terms as something that made the world a problem of economic calculation, in a sense. And in this sense, they pretty much, again, replicated what economists see as money, as the function of money as a tool for bartering. And this is very much related to what is called the modernization thesis, or the idea of the theory of how modernity came about. If you look at what anthropologists say, they talk about special monies. How in some cultures, in some groups, they have tokens of exchange that work like money but are not precisely money. In what way aren't they money? They're not emitted by a central bank. They do not have the same economic dynamics as money, for instance, but they allow exchange to happen. Classical examples of that are coffee beans in some societies, or cocoa beans in other societies, or these huge discs that they have in the Pacific Islands that functioned as money. And sociologists argued, or at least classical sociologists argued, that as societies modernized, that money became market money. So all these very unique and distinctive forms of special purpose monies became something called market money. And this is called the modernization thesis. And basically, what this involves is that a complex, rich social world for money was made homogeneous. And this is the world, argue these sociologists, where we live today. Now the question can be asked, is all the money the same? Is all money equal? Are they correct? Are all these modern monies that we know of today the same? So this is what we'll discover in a bit. The first thing that we have to observe is that actually money has different, there are different monies, even though physically it is the same coin, the same token. Sociologically, there are different monies that come out of that same token. So we can think about money categories that are very important in the way in which people deal with money and people act with money in the world. One of those, the ways in which those categories emerges is by earmarking. If you read the newspapers, if you look at the news, if you sort of talk about money or look at talks about the way people talk about money, you'll see that money is sort of thought of as a stream, as something that can be divided and allocated according to specific purposes. So for instance, you can see in some papers that people talk about how charitable contributions will go into blah, 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 or how this part of the national budget will go into this specific bit of activity, education or science or whatever, or how some forms of money, dirty money, can be laundered and made clean. Now this is very interesting because at the end of the day, a £5 note is just that, it's a £5 note. And when you pay your taxes, it all goes into the same pot, and you really can't say that this £5 note that you're giving to the taxman is going to go to that particular thing. But that's not how we think about money. We think about money in terms of these categories, money as having a function that is earmarked beforehand. And that allows us to do some things with money. It allows us to organize our lives and to think about such complex things as national budgets, which are extremely difficult to actually grasp. And this is related to another characteristic of money, in a sense, which is something called mental accounting. And mental accounting is a very interesting psychological propensity of people, of individuals, to deal with money figures in a particular way. So this is a we exercise. What would you do if you found a £50 note on the street? What would you do with that note? Think of it for a second. So, what would you do with that money? Yeah. Take it, but what would you do after taking it? So you have the £50 note. What do you do with that? Yeah.
Probably think of things I could buy with it.
Yeah. What would you buy?
Shoes.
Shoes. What else? Yeah.
I put it into savings.
You put it into savings, okay? Yeah. Yeah.
I take it to the police. I don't know that.
Okay, you take it to the police. Who would go out for a dinner that they didn't expect to have? Or, yeah, so, who would buy something that they wouldn't have bought otherwise? Probably everyone. If you do this survey with people on the street, you'll see that they'll end up doing something with that money that wasn't planned. You're a very rational being, because very few people would actually put it in savings. Statistically speaking, the amount of people who would do with that money something that they would have done with their regular income is about 5% of the population, which is something very irrational from an economic perspective. The rational thing is to take that money and put it into the same use as your normal income streams. But people actually don't do that. And it gets even more bizarre when you start to think of other ways in which money is allocated. It's not, if you get an unexpected tax return, for instance, it's not used in the same way as money you find in the street. They're both money. They're both coins, in a sense, and bills at the end of the day, but they're used in different ways. Unexpected tax returns go into savings and go into household expenses and those types of activities, whereas for some bizarre reason, we think of money that is found on the street as something that can be used for going out and having a pint with friends. And that is something that is very common to human beings, and it's called mental accounting. So actually, the way in which we create these mental budgets that are very much artificial and socially determined to some extent determines how we deal with the flows of money that go into our pockets, our households, etc., etc. There's another thing that is quite interesting, and this has to do with the way in which we react to money as something that is probabilistic in a sense. So let's think of this example. Mr. A was given tickets to lotteries involving the World Series. He won $50 in one lottery and $25 in the other. Mr. B was given a ticket to a single larger lottery, World Series lottery. He won $75. Who was happier? Who? A. But it's the same amount of money. Why are you happier if it's the same amount of money? It doesn't make any rational sense. That's another odd thing about the way we think about money. We are not actually rational beings in society. We are happier with two smaller outcomes than with a larger equivalent outcome. And that is something that economics would not predict, and that is something that sociology explores to some degree in a sense. There's another example. Mr. A received a letter from the IRS saying that he made a minor arithmetical mistake on his tax return and owed $100. He received a similar letter from the state income tax authority saying he owed $50. There was no other repercussion from either mistake. Mr. B received a letter from the IRS saying that he made a minor arithmetical mistake on his tax return and owed $150. There were no other repercussions. Who was more upset? Mr. B. Why? Because it's a larger sum, in a sense. It's an odd rationale that we have, odd logic that we have with money. And that's something that also economics is not capable of dealing with, and that is very much at the basis of social behavior around money. So it's not only that money is powerful, etc., but it's also that the way we deal with money is conditioned by these peculiar social predispositions, in a sense. There's a third aspect that makes money relevant and interesting for sociology, and that is what is called special monies. If you'll recall from a couple of slides ago, anthropologists think that back in the days, societies were more quote-unquote primitive because they had special monies, and that modernity is special because we no longer have those special monies. We are more rational and more modern about money than what they were back then. But actually a really nice, one of the classical studies in the sociology of money is precisely about how special monies still exist in society. And that study concerns what was called the fiscal problem in domestic economies, in a sense, and household economies. And it's a problem that traces to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when sociology was also emerging as a discipline, and that emerged from the fact that women were becoming involved in the labor force, in the paid labor force, and were bringing money into the household. An odd fact about that social transformation is that the money that was brought into the household by women was not considered as valuable as the money earned by men. So money, to some extent, was gendered. Who brought the money in gave that particular bit of money, that pot of money, a specific value. And there's a form of money that was, or a pot of money, a type of money that was talked about at the time, which was pin money. Pin money was this type of money that was earned by people doing small jobs, generally women, and that was brought into the household to complement the household income, in a sense. And an interesting article from Harper's Bazaar, the very famous Harper's Bazaar, noted that no man works for pin money. The very idea makes one smile. So it's very interesting to see how money itself is special. There still are special monies out there in the world, and those say very clear things about how society is organized. For instance, in this case, that gender is a key element in how households are organized, and how gender makes some forms of money more valuable than others. And this all brings us to the idea that money actually has meanings. It's not something passive, it's not only a token of exchange, it's something embedded and imbued with meaning to some extent. And this meaning is defined by culture, defined by how social institutions are built, by what we understand as our role in the world and in society. And the best example of how these cultural boundaries play a role in money, in the meaning of money, is provided by Seinfeld. Does anyone know what Seinfeld is? It was a really great show, which sort of ended years ago. But it has a very nice example on how money has different meanings. Mm-hmm. Let me try to get this to work. It's not working. This is terrible. Well, basically, this is Seinfeld. This is Elaine. And they were going out at the time. Seinfeld didn't want to take the relationship too seriously. It was Elaine's birthday, so he gave her a present. What was the present? You'll see in a second. It was $182 in cash. So why is that wrong? Of course, this caused a huge problem in the relationship, etc., etc. Elaine wasn't too happy with having received $182 in cash as her birthday present. A friend then comes in and gives Elaine a bench that she really wanted to buy, and she is very happy and starts to complain with Seinfeld about the fact that he gave her money. And she says something of the sort, what, are you my uncle? To Seinfeld. Why? Because, generally speaking, you expect to get money in cash from your uncle, but not your partner in life. Why is that? Why is it bizarre if someone that is very close to you gives you cash as a present? What is wrong in that? What sounds peculiar? At the end of the day, it's not wrong. It's not something different from giving another person an iPad or whatever. It's simply a social convention, a sort of morality that we attach to money that is completely socially determined. We could give people money, we could behave like uncles and give people checks, but that is somehow something that doesn't work too well with our attitudes towards money, with the way in which our societies have built or have organized around money. So that's sort of the idea of what the sociology of money is. Money is this complex entity, it's very social, and it hasn't actually evolved too much in the last 3,000 years. There are still special monies, and those special monies, or the study of those special monies, says quite a bit about our modern societies. So actually we can say that Weber, Durkheim, etc., were a bit wrong, and they got it slightly wrong. And that's something cool about sociology, you can criticize people quite a lot. So it's a very nice area for doing that. So now that was an idea of what sociology looks like. Let's talk about the department. We have about 400 students. That's across the undergraduate and graduate programs. And in terms of the undergraduate program, we have about 110 students. As you can see, the sizes of the cohort is relatively small, but because it's small, it's more intimate and you can discuss things in more detail, and it's a very nice environment for studying ASS. We have the BSc in sociology and also a series of other MSc courses on different topics that reflect the interest of the teaching staff. And in terms of the teaching staff, we have about 25 individuals, from professors to lecturers, and it goes all the way through, and the interests are extremely broad. Actually, the interests are reflected in this thing that is called research clusters. That's a sort of mechanism that we came up with to organize our identity, to sort of think about what we do. There's a cluster on human rights, citizenship, and social justice, and they do quite a lot of things on social rights. They have a very popular set of courses. There's a very, very popular, internationally renowned cluster on cities, and they do studies on the sociology of cities and urbanism, etc. We have people who have expertise on gender, economy and society. The politics and society cluster of the LSE is one of the key reference in British sociology. So actually there's a lot of work done on political sociology here at the LSE. Race, racism and ethnicity is another key cluster. People such as Paul Gilroy are there, and they're extremely popular and extremely well received and very, very acclaimed researchers in that group. And there's one on crime, culture, and control. There are some people also doing things on biomedicine, but they are not as big. There's a couple of people doing that, but they're also extremely interesting researchers. The nice thing is that these clusters translate into the way in which things are taught. So people tend to teach their expertise in courses, in classes, etc., and they tend to convey the exciting bits of the forefront of sociology in their lectures. So these expertise are very important to understand the things that are brought into the lectures and seminars at the LSE, in a sense. And I am part of the Economy and Society cluster, and to give you an illustration of how each of these clusters is a world in itself, or is a very complex ecology in itself, I'll show you what we do in that one. In that particular cluster, we have 6 people, more or less. The identities shift from time to time. Nigel Dodd, who's a world expert on money. Bridget Hutter, who's an expert on risk. Patrick McGovern, who works on issues of employment, migration, etc. Don Slater, who is quite renowned for his work on consumption and media, internet, etc. And Fran Tonkis, who is an expert on globalization and issues of governance and the world economy, in a sense. And I work on finance. That's sort of my main topic. And we teach courses, or we teach lectures related to this. I'm actually more involved with the methods teaching at the undergraduate level, and we'll discuss that in a second. And the best example of sort of the worth of the department is all the things we produce. In academia, we like to write quite a lot, and you'll see when you go into the department that there's this huge, there's a wall full of books at the entrance, and it seems imposing, and it seems impersonal, and it seems like something that means that the people who wrote those books are isolated from you, but actually they aren't. They're pretty much there. They're quite approachable. Those books are things that you can engage with through the authors, which is something quite interesting. You can discuss concepts from sociology with people who are doing sociology in the forefront of the field, in a sense, in the vanguard of the field. So what does a degree look like? Well, it has three components, or 3 years, in a sense, and I'm sure you know some of this. I have a copy of the structure of the program, so I can give you this as a handout. It has an indication of the different paths and along. So the first year you take 2 compulsory courses, key concepts and key issues, and they give you 2 distinct approaches. What are those approaches? Concepts give you a notion of what is the theoretical core of sociology. So this is where you see Durkheim and Simmel and Marx and all those folks. Key issues is a slightly different course because there you analyze particular topics and you try to dissect them from a sociological perspective. So this one shows a little bit more how sociology is done and how sociology takes place in the world. There's also a course on statistical methods, which is very introductory, so there's nothing to be worried about that one. And you have a choice of an additional course in the first year. So the first year is really about cementing the theory, in a sense, giving you those theoretical instruments that you'll use later on for your sort of careers in sociology. The second year is about thinking in sociological terms and formalizing those tools through research. So there's a couple of courses, compulsory courses, sociological analysis. That course introduces you to the ways of thinking sociologically. In what sense? It tells you a little bit of how you can understand a sociological project, a sociological question, and use theory to understand that particular question and integrate that to methods and see the validity of methods, the role of methods. There's also a course on methods that gives you the practical instruments that you'll need to do research. And in addition to that, you can select 2 courses, one from within the department and one that can be an outside option in a sense. So you can tailor your degree pretty much according to your interest, your particular interest and expertise in a sense. And the third year is a really exciting year because I can be in that course, the sociological project, and that's where you become sociologists in all practical terms. The second year is about methods, the first year is about theory, the third year is about doing things and showing what you know. The sociological project is a year-long course, and you pick the question, you pick the topic, you pick the methods, you pick the theory, you pick everything. And you write a 10,000-word document on that thing. And it's a very interesting experience because people write the most amazing things. There's someone working on TrueLad. It's apparently a website. You might know what TrueLad is. Someone is doing an analysis of how gender is represented in TrueLad and how that talks about specific identities in society. And that's a 10,000-word project. They have to come up with a theory that makes that relevant with the methods. They have to go into the website, take the pieces of information that are relevant, and then write that all up in a cohesive piece of scholarship. So this is where you actually become a sociologist. This is where you prove all the things that you've learned and when you show what doing sociology is all about. And it's a very original piece of work. People do everything. They do the sociology of human rights. Some people are doing the riots. That's another very important topic this year. There's people doing just about everything. E-commerce in India, it's amazing, the variety. And you're taken through the course, through a series of workshops that teach you how to deal with software, how to write an extended sociological paper, how to refine your methods, your theories, etc., etc. So you're not left alone, you're accompanied throughout the whole experience, and you come out being pretty much a sociologist, and you can be proud of yourselves and call yourself a sociologist. And that's probably the best thing that can happen. In addition to that, you can take 2 other courses from within or out with the department. So it's a very rich program. It allows you to tailor your experience to your particular interests. And actually, the project is something that allows people to go into the work, the sort of the labor market, because it's something in which people can explore particular things that then become relevant for their careers. For instance, you can do things on development and go into an NGO and use the project as a stepping stone for that career in NGOs or development studies, etc., etc. So actually, what is it like after the LSE? Well, at the LSE, you gain all those experiences, you gain those theories, those methods, and that practical training. And that is something that is extremely valuable when you hit the employment world, in a sense. People go from sociology to the civil service, local government, that's quite common, but they also go into industry, management consulting, and public relations, human resource management, etc., etc. Those things are also areas in which sociology graduates have added value, in a sense. Think tanks, for those who love to do research, are another particular area where they can excel. Charities that are related to think tanks too, educational authorities, social work. There is a world of possibilities. The nice thing about sociology is that it gives you these tools to understand the world. It makes you critical in analyzing these complex events of modern societies. It gives you expertise on talking about these great transformations, and that's something that few degrees give you. It makes you critical, it makes you proactive, it makes you someone who can engage with things that are complex and make them simple, make them understandable. So that is why it's a brilliant degree, in a sense, and it's something that we aim to do throughout the 3 years. And it's something that I hope you will enjoy if we see you in October. And it's something that I think would be fantastic to do together. So thank you again, welcome. There will be a meet and greet almost across the hall. It's in room 204. And you'll be able to chat with other members of the department, to ask more questions, to sort of get an idea of what things are in more detail. But before that, are there any questions? Do you have any things that you'd like to ask? Any things that you'd like to raise, comments? I do apologize about the weather. I hoped it was going to be sunny and nice, but then again, we needed a rain. Great, well, thank you very much. Remember, room 204, there'll be some materials there that are very useful for understanding the degree, handbooks, etc., etc., so please do come.